You're listening to a ComicsXF podcast. Interview podcast to the show where two best friends talk about comics with the people who make them. I'm Dan Grote.
And I'm Matt Lazowitz. And this week's guest is the writer and organizer of the Zoop campaign for Comics Are Dying, The Comic, A Brief History of the Comic Book Industry, Lewis Southard. Welcome, Lewis.
Hello, guys. Thank you so much for having me. I've been a big fan of the show, and I've been on once before, and I'm really glad to be back. I love talking comics with you guys, so I know we're in for a big treat.
And I love when guests remember they've been here, because that is not always the case. Especially just for like a few minutes on one of the convention episodes. Oh, man.
I really appreciated it. The fact that anytime anyone comes up to me and is like, let's talk Midnight Western Theater. I'm like, okay, you're already my best friend. You are now never going to be forgotten in my brain. So
speaking of that, our usual first-time guest icebreaker is the first comics that they remember reading. But I asked you that at Fan Expo Philly last year. So to tie in with this project, what is the first comics history book or comic or something that you remember reading and encountering?
That's a very tricky question right there. Well, when I started reading comics, very much big two publisher, right? And as I grew older, you kind of get sick of that, right? And you want to see like, what else is there? So as I've gotten older, I've like very much read pretty much a little bit of everything. But in terms of like, especially with this project, of at a formative age, learning what comics could be, like the variety of them, my kind of gateway was Grant Morrison's Multiversity, because that was coming out. I was reading that while that was coming out. And that's one of those special books where each issue is a new number one in a different genre and told in a very different way. And as a medium that was like, very impressive from my perspective. Like, that's very cool to see how diverse a comic series can even be done. And like each book, like there's a lot of history behind the ideas for each issue. So obviously I wanted to learn more about the inspirations for each thing. And then, you know, that leads you to learn about like Fawcett Comics and Charlton Comics. And then you have to like learn more about that. And just going through like the different publishers, the different eras, why they're not around, you know, it basically my entire comics fandom and my own personal life has led to me having to learn as much as I can just to understand the majority of what the heck is even going on in a lot of these books. I know that's a bit bold, but I know a lot of people. That's like, I think a lot of people getting into comics, that's one of the most intimidating factors, just, you know, trying to understand the history of what's come before. That's why we all love a good jumping on point. But for me, I enjoy the challenge of like learning all the inspirations and what's come before. And I feel like that's very reflected in this newest book, Comics Are Dying, The Comic, where we really capture we try to capture every era and genre possible.
I usually don't ask these questions to throw in my own anecdote, but this one, as I was thinking about it, the first bit of comic book history, and I use that in the biggest scare quotes possible, was Bob Kane's autobiography, Batman and Me, which I have little doubt, knowing everything that we know about Bob Kane, somebody else wrote that book.
I love his tombstone, you know, where it's like, God put me on Earth to make Batman, and that is what I did, and everyone will know this, and that is that. And it's like, Okay, I think we all got it. Like you came up with the idea. No, we have a page in the book that references the creation of Batman, because I know I'm sure we all know the infamous red-suited, large-winged version, and then of course Bill Finger came in and tidied everything up, just a little bit. So like, yeah, no, you gotta re with comics. There's a lot of exaggeration, embellishment, as Stan Lee would say. So you have to kind of like root through it and find the truth in the middle, or find the majority of truth in order to portray a somewhat accurate history, or at least non-biased. But you can also just look at the credits of what people contributed versus like what they simply put their name on. That makes sense.
I'm trying to think if I have an answer to this question now. Somebody lent me at work like a Jim Steranko history of comics. It went up to like I want to say the end of the 60s or something like that. It was like a first volume. That might have been my first sort of comics history, but I've read a bunch of them, including Josie Riesman's totally depressing biography of Stan Lee. That might be a favorite, but
I recently read that Tom Scioli, I Am Stan book, and that is depressing right out the gate, because it starts with the the guy, the handler, basically telling him how to spell his own name. So that really sets the tone with the kind of journey you're going to go on. But yeah, no, yeah, no, comics history, as depressing as it can be, like this whole book is more of a love letter and is more optimistic. Of course, we do reference some of the low points in some people's careers and journeys, but as you know, that's the responsible thing to do, to acknowledge it. But at the same time, we want it to be like a very, as I said, optimistic, hopeful, and hopefully somewhat inspiring thing, because you know, people have been saying comics are dying for what, 80 years? So it's just like, you know what, it's not going anywhere. It's always changing. It's always something different. And that's what the root of this book is. It's just an ever-evolving art form, and it's, I think, going to stay for as long as we'll have it.
so let's get into that. The what we're here to talk about is Comics Are Dying, colon, the comic, a graphic novel in which you and more than 100 artists craft a bunch of one-pagers piecing together the history of comics from the 1800s on. What was the origin of this project? When did you first say, I'm going to take on this massive, complicated thing?
Well, like all good things, it was rooted in anger. I was really pissed off by the end of 2023. There was a lot of rage and outcries online around the end of the year saying, "Oh, comics are dying, comics are terrible now, blah blah blah." And I had enough. And I saw a lot of big creators taking advantage of the situation, but at the same time, they're not really doing anything to fix anything. It's more just fueling the fans of the fire, which is obviously the very sexy thing to do on the internet. For me, I came at it with the more prudish more prudish way of going to a more optimistic and helpful thing. Because I always had the idea of a book where every page was done by a completely different artist. I just never knew what the theme was. So with all that happening, I was like, oh, why not the entire history of the Western comic book industry? And like that's the ultimate way to convey different styles and like to have a bunch of artists like play on a bunch of different things. So I started in January. And I finished tail end of March, and that was a time. Definitely felt with, filled with sleepless nights and definitely some burnout, because managing 100 of my closest friends certainly a lot more difficult than I initially thought. But I'm very happy with how it turned out. And I think the book overall is just a very passionate love letter, and it's just a very like wonderful artistic showcase of some of the best people working today. So I could not be more proud of what we made, really.
So as you said, there's online outcry because everything can be found online. But at a con, in a shop or anything, have you ever actually run into a creator, a fellow creator of, maybe a previous generation who's like, yeah, comics are dying. No names necessary, but have you ever encountered that actually in the wild?
In real life, at my local shop, there is a gentleman who's always there. Anytime, he's always loitering, and he is the first. He always asks me what I think of the latest Spider-Man, which I don't even read, but he always asks me what I think of it. And then it's like, well, it's no good. It's all falling apart. No one knows what they're doing anymore. And I'm like, like fair enough. Like anyway, I'm just gonna buy my book and I'm gonna leave. In terms of like fans, believe me, there are tons of passionate fans who are willing to tell you what's going on. In terms of creators in the real life, I'm fortunate enough that a lot of the people I've met and have become friends with in the real world are very much hopeful people, just doing it because they love it and they're trying to make careers out of it, or they already have a career and they're just trying to sustain it and do the best they can. I don't really want to spend too much time around people that hate everything that's going on. I'd much rather spend time with people trying their best to make the best damn books they can, and even art. So those are the people I kind of go out of my way to find, and everyone else I sort of try to tune out, at least in the real world. Online, you're like, oh, what's going on today? And you're a bit doomed. They call it doom scrolling for a reason. So
It's just a fire hose of yelling. But the good news is your project is already funded. It was funded within just a couple of days of going live. So where do you go from here?
well, right now I'm saying we're on the road to 10K, because right now
Okay.
we're a little over 7,500. So we need 2,500 more to unlock our first stretch goal, which is basically the first goal is to add a director's commentary. I don't know if I've said this, but each page is basically a different historical event or about a different book or character or creator in comics history. Basically, the director's commentary, while I want this book to be a springboard for people, if they don't know a certain thing, they can go learn it themselves. I also feel like there's a lot of fun Easter eggs that will go over people's heads. So I feel like adding that will really improve the experience. And then after that, we have another stretch goal. And if we reach that, that's basically to add 10 more pages with 10 more artists to add to our ranks, and basically cover some of the things we miss. Now, it's a brief history. 250 years of stuff is a lot, I'm not gonna lie. So we couldn't cover everything. And I apologize to you directly, listener, if I missed your favorite thing. But the additional 10 pages is my apology for that. And hopefully we'll be able to rectify that. I know two pages that are locked down if we get to the second stretch goal. One will be about like the first ever biggest web comic, which is Homestuck, and then the other one will be inspired by the Captain Marvel and the Monster Society of Evil, which is like the first story arc in comics. So those definitely are going to be included, but that is all dependent on people supporting the book.
Why did you bring this project to Zoop versus another crowdfunding platform or publisher?
That's a great question. I've been telling people, which is the truth, but I'm a very sleepy guy. I like to sleep in. I don't like being awake. I love my bed. And I when like there are a lot of braver people than I that can handle the intensity of a Kickstarter, of promoting that then you have to print your book, then you have to ship it out, you have to make all the extra caboodles, and that's too much for little old me. So luckily, Zoop is a wonderful alternative where they handle the printing and manufacturing and distribution of all materials that are part of the campaign. And Jordan Plosky and Eric Moss, the co-founders, run such a smooth ship that I can keep sleeping and I don't have to worry about anything. I get to just sleep and do all the fun stuff, which is stay on the creative side of things, make the book, and also do like what we're doing right now and promote the book, which is definitely more my speed.
How was organizing this many artists, colorists, letterers, designers, etc. in this project?
A nightmare. I said this before, but I had a lot of burnout and I was very much overwhelmed. It all started with a lovely spreadsheet where I came up with the 100 fun facts or historical bits. And then after that, I reached out to every past collaborator that still likes me. So so that's like two people. So I reached out to them, asked them if they'd like to be part of it, and a bunch of people said yes. And then after that, I asked them if they knew anybody else that would be, looking for a job or was interested in, and then people sent their recommendations. I put a few calls out, and then I did a small press release, even announcing the book in, at all, and I put an open call saying we're looking for more people. And I was very blessed because the Kubert School and the Savannah School College of Art and Design, their staff and their student body, very excited by this project. So I got a lot of applications from them. So I spent 3 months making this and just being bombarded by emails every day, and mixed with editing, writing the scripts, and making sure everyone got the perfect story for their art style, because I feel like I wanted to play to everyone's strengths. I've been giving examples when talking about it. Like, there's this great artist, Sean Peacock, and he can do his art is he can do a hell of a Kirby homage. So obviously, you want him to do the Kirby inspired page, and he does the one called Neo Ragnarok, which is basically the page inspired by the New Gods. So you really want every, because this is not just about me, it's having all the artists display their talents, show off what they can do, and you want to make sure that they are playing on their strengths. And I think everyone really did their best, and it really shows in a lot of the pages. I would say all of the pages.
Apart from that example, did you have sort of an idea of how you generally went about matching artist to history point?
No, it was all jazz. It was all improv, really. I had the spreadsheet. If I like, a lot of people applied, and there were a lot of people who are very talented. But if I didn't see anything that they would be applicable for, I unfortunately had to send a rejection. Basically, I needed to match everyone up. There were people where there wasn't even a script written, but just seeing their art and then finding the right fact, it's like, oh, well, there it is. Sometimes you need the visual stimulus. So like kind of some of it was kind of going running on the spot, and then other stuff was planned. Like I already had an idea for before I even made it. Like some of the stories where I knew what I wanted straight away was like the Mr. A page by Ditko. I knew I wanted that because I'm a big fan of Mr. A. Like a lot of the Superman inspired stuff with our character Mr. Infinite. I know the one by Kerry Callan, the Mr. Infinite. It's Infinite V Ultra, which is basically a fun pastiche on the Fawcett versus National Comics lawsuit. So like there were a lot of ideas beforehand, but as the project continued, very much having to work quickly and on the spot while still trying to maintain a certain level of quality.
Was it any more of a reach getting Mark Waid to write the foreword than it was any of the other creators involved?
Would you believe that's probably one of the easiest bits? Him and I started speaking to each other back last year. I was writing a book called The Blackout Bombshell, and I wanted to get some pull quotes for it. So I reached out to him. I asked him if he could, and he said yes. And me as a nerd, you are now speaking to Mark Waid. So you have to ask a bunch of questions, like as many as you can without bothering him. So I asked a lot about the current World's Finest and his Shazam run, because I'm a big Captain Marvel guy. So like I just wanted to I had to bug him. And then when I came up with this idea, I felt like this would be something really up his alley. I know he's a big proponent of like progressivism in comics and like trying to, keep things like decent and good instead of letting everything fall apart. So I pitched it to him and he said, just give him like a couple weeks. And sure enough, he kept his word. And I really appreciate him doing it and taking time out of his very, very busy schedule. Because you look at the absolute power lineup, the fact that he could fit that in was a very, very generous thing. And he's a very great guy.
Excellent. So, what is your favorite way that comics have almost died? I am personally partial to the 90s speculator bust and Marvel declaring bankruptcy, although I will say the DC implosion of the late 1970s is a close second.
Yeah, that's that whole living through that impl the Marvel implosion era. You and I, pure old fogies that we are now.
Yes, veterans of the war.
I have to say the probably the most interesting bit is learning about the comics code in the 50s, and then like going back and reading some of the pre-code comics. You can understand like okay, they were getting away with a lot for like kids like comics for kids. But at the same time, like a lot of the nutso stuff they were coming up with to censor the books came from a really foul and negative place. Very and like the guy Frederick Wortham, the guy making it up, that literally just that he was just partly coming up with it as he went along, and probably because of that, like I'm a big EC Comics fan. Like I definitely had to include like that little story arc. The best thing about comics are dying, while each page is like an individual, factor or historical event or character or whatever, some of them are unofficial two-parters. So you will find that it's connected to one later down in the book. One of my favorite ones is the EC Comics one, where basically it's like a drug bust where the cops are storming in a building, but instead of finding like drug dealers, it's all like Draculas and werewolves and everything, to symbolize how they cracked down on horror comics and they pretty much went extinct in the 50s. And then the two-parter is like in the 1970s in our book, it cuts to a prison and a jail warden is opening up a cell and so you're free to go, and it's all the Draculas and werewolves and everything. Except now they're all tatted up because they've been roughened up in prison. So no, I like that's a good deal of fun. I'm sure at the time it wasn't good fun, but for me learning about it, it definitely adds to the drama and intrigue of the overall story.
So, as the EC stuff, is it the horror stuff you're a fan of? The crime, the little bit of everything? I'm just always curious about where people hit that stuff, because I'm a huge fan of the EC crime comics and horror comics, both. Those are two of my favorite genres in general.
Well, in my collection, I have a lot of I think it's the Dark Horse collections, the modern reprints, and I mainly like going in them because of the art involved. Because there's, I think mainly, I'm not gonna lie, I haven't touched them in a long time, but the main incentive for buying them was I wanted to look at a lot of Wally Wood art, and he really contributed to that. Not to go on a tangent, but right now I'm on a Alex Toth binge where I bought all of his what is it? It's like artists isolated and artists illustrated and artists animated. So I'm really trying to dig in on that. I like the whole point of this book is I really love the history of comics, and I like digging into all the different facets that I when I was younger, I'm like, I don't need to learn about that. I read Spider-Man, I'm cool. I don't need to know more about any of this. But now that in my old age, I really like to dig deep and try to learn as much as I can, just because it's interesting to see where everything kind of came from.
I think we may have already answered this question, but who is comics' biggest IRL villain?
That is it. You know what? Okay. Good answer. Itself. I would say
Ooh.
that the industry is a it's an Ouroboros in a way, where we contribute to our own problems as opposed to maybe innovating and fixing them or trying alternatives. And I think if you look at like every 20 to 30 years, you see a lot of the same things end up repeating itself. And you kind of end up in situations where we were before. So I think we are really the biggest obstacle in the way. I think as time has gone on, we are slowly trying to improve, but I don't really see as much as I would personally like. I know the big thing everyone always says is like, manga versus comics, you know, like what's going on there. And I do agree that somebody asked me the other day if it's are single issues the problem. And I think single issues should exist. I love going to the comic book store every Wednesday and getting my book, but I feel that can only really be sustained with like a quality over quantity ideology at some of these larger publishers. Because I this is this is an opinion statement, but like I hate miniseries. I hate 4-issue, 6-issue miniseries. And I shouldn't say that because I work in the industry and I'm actively always trying to get a miniseries going because that's the thing. But any comic that I personally love was a run. And even modern comics, like the last big modern, let's say Big Two comic that I'm like, this was great. It was Immortal Hulk by Al Ewing. And that is a very much a, it felt like classic Marvel. Like it referenced a lot of stuff that came before while still being really innovative with its storytelling. And you never really felt like you were missing anything. But if you were a longtime Hulk fan, you saw things and it felt like everything paid off. It's respecting its history. I know jumping from that to Smashdronaut was definitely a lot of tonal whiplash for a lot of people. No hate to Donny Cates, but yeah, no, I love long running series, and I feel like that is not really a priority anymore, and I think that's a real shame. I think like doing that again with like your select titles. And then, if you want to do a miniseries, release it as a graphic novel. Because, from my perspective, if you're releasing that idea as a miniseries, you really kind of don't believe in it at all. So you're just kind of like, we're shoving it out there. It's out. It's done. So I would imagine why not just sell that as the just a one and done. But you know, that's just my perspective. But back on the manga thing, yeah, no, I think with them. That's an easy thing. It's a lot of evergreen titles. And I mentioned to somebody else that less so DC is a lot better at it than Marvel, but there needs to be more of like an evergreen catalog of books that are always on the shelf that you can always hand to people. And not just recent stuff, but stuff from the entire history of the comics. You know, like you go to the DC section, you'll always see Watchmen. You'll always see Dark Knight Returns. You'll always see All-Star Superman, stuff like that. And I know they are expanding with the pocket-sized editions and the like they're doing like an epic collection thing with a lot of their older books. I really like that. I'm really happy about that. And with Marvel, I feel like they're a bit slacking in that regard. They are doing a good thing with the modern Epic collections, which I appreciate, but I feel like you will not see a lot of their. I can't remember the last time I've been to a bookstore and I saw a copy of Civil War on the shelf. And a comic shop's different, but going to a bookstore, I don't really see like the selection that there should be. But maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But yeah, no, that's my opinion. Okay, I'm gonna stop now before I'm blacklisted by all these companies. I've said too much.
The van is waiting outside.
Yeah,
So what is something researching the history for this book that you didn't know beforehand or that surprised you?
I would say a lot of the Platinum Age stuff and a lot of the underground comics stuff, those were real big blind spots for me. Learning about Little Nemo in Slumberland was a real joy, and everything with Windsor McKay. And then with Underground, I gotta say, I don't have a lot of even learning about it. I'm like, I have no love for you. I hate to say that, Robert Crumb, but I have no affinity. But obviously, I had to acknowledge it. And learning about like the first ever kind of underground comics was the New Adventures of Jesus. That definitely tickled me. And then learning about like the early movements in, I think, San Francisco, like that was very interesting. But it didn't capture me in a flight of fancy. Just very much like, okay, I get it, and here you are. But yeah, I don't. I those are underground comics represented. Not my favorite. Glad to know more about it because big blind spot. But the Platinum Age, that was more interesting because that is the great grandfathers of all this. So Little Nemo in Slumberland, the Yellow Kid. That dumb little bears and tykes thing that William Randolph Hearst thought was amazing. I put that in there, and that one's probably the most mean-spirited one in the entire book, where it's just like people are like, this is so funny, and it's just a bear just saying silly things. And I think around 1902, that probably was the most hysterical thing you'd ever seen in your entire life. So yeah.
You are allowed to be mean to William Randolph Hearst. That, speaking of historical villains, that guy deserves it.
I should really make a movie critiquing his entire life. I think that'd be a big hit.
Yeah, man, I think a few years down the line, people might still be talking about
Maybe.
So throughout here, you're discussing quite a lot of copyrighted material. And crafting pages that are just close enough to be obvious, but not so close as to bring lawyers wearing mouse ears down upon your head. How tricky was treading that line?
Dancing between the raindrops, my friend. Like, that's very much the deal with this. There are plenty of books more famous than I, or than this one, that have plenty of homages and pastiches, and they get away with it. So this was really no different. A lot of the earlier stuff, I was lucky enough that we could use public domain. Like Hugo Hercules was like the first real superpowered hero in comic strips. So putting him in, I can actually use him. Same thing, funnily enough, same thing with the Reign of the Superman, the proto Superman comic. That's in the public domain as well. So, but obviously I'm not dumb enough to put the word Superman in the book. So I really worked my way around that while still working within the parameters. Luckily we're working under parody and satire. And this is a very loving joke. And a lot of the other stuff is based around historical precedent. So like it's a retelling of what's been already told. So overall we've been very safe, and we've basically gotten the green light. Everything's okay. And these are very legally distinct characters that are original, and they are 100% mine. And I can do whatever the heck I want with them. I see. I could have been greedy. I could have put Steamboat Willie in there, but I didn't because I'm a good person.
Not so much a question as an observation, but as I got a little bit into the book, I had a lot of fun trying to kind of take in the whole page and figuring out what this was about before actually reading the text. Like I was playing a little game of, okay, I think looking at this art, this is Kirby. This is that's got to be Mr. A throughout the whole book. It was a fun little game.
Well, that's good. I feel like this book is very interactive in a lot of different ways. One of the big selling points is this is a brief history. So I feel like if you are a comics fan, hope maybe you know pretty much a lot of the stuff going in. But a lot of this, I spoke to one person who read it and it's like, I got to this page and I didn't believe you at all. So I Googled it and I was surprised that that was even a real thing. And I'm like, that's exactly the point. Like, you 100% got what this book is about. I also feel like it's great for a lot of younger comics fans that maybe don't know a lot about the overall industry and the different genres, because we try to hit every beat, all the different types of cape and tights comics, ranging from like Golden Age to Marvel Bullpen to 90s Extreme. We do Funny Animal, Underground, Sword and Sorcery. You name it, it's pretty much there. Even Pulp Fiction, we got it. So I think like giving it to people and then being like, oh, well, that was interesting. I want to learn more. Well, we have this beautiful thing called Google. So it's like, oh, cool. Like I can now, this is like a gateway drug. I shouldn't say that. It's a gateway book where it's like perfect. Like you now have the fun fact, you have the idea, and now it's up to you to really dig in if you're that interested, which I think is great fun. Yeah, no, I'm very happy with how with all the ground we covered, and I really hope people like have fun with it because while this is historical and it is learning, I feel with the way it's presented, you will smile and you will have a laugh and you will see like a lot of the love and like sheer amount of detail we put into it. So I think it'll be a very enjoyable experience for all the readers who get their hands on it.
Were the fake ads any more fun or challenging than the story pages?
I made all the ads and I had so much fun making the ads. I wanted to, like with the way the book is progressing, I tried to make sure the ads progressed in the years as well. So like the first ad you see, I believe, is the like it has the vibe of the X-ray vision cutaway page. So like it homages the pet monkey that was in a lot of the old comics. And then the rest I kind of had to make up as I went along. My favorite little detail in that was coming up with like the little cut slip that you have to mail away. And I came up with my fake industry, Gaggo Industries, and that got a laugh out of me. The other one was a toy ad, very much inspired by the superpowers ad. My partner is now a hand model because they are holding the fake toy that is in the ad. And then the other one was based on like 90s and 2000s video game ads that you would find in a lot of comics. And then the other two, those were more jokey ones. One was like a fake like Marvel inspired ad like they would have in the 60s, and the other one was like a legal ad inspired by the X-ray eye X-ray vision goggles. But I gotta be honest, my most favorite back matter thing I made is the letters page all the way at the very end of the book. I had so much fun writing up all the fake letters from the various different types of comic fans that I feel are out there, and writing them in that kind of like smiling Stan demeanor with like trying to crack wise and being jokey with all the letters. So that was definitely the most fun I had because it's fun writing an exaggerated version of yourself and also trying to write an entirely different human being with their own very strong opinion.
Matt, I don't know if you caught this. I think it was on the Karl Barks Uncle Scrooge page, the Roy Brisby reference.
You beat me to putting that in there, because when I went, I was gonna like, oh, did you see the fish? And like, oh no, you already beat me to that one on there. Mandalay, I've come aflame again.
I love the Venture Brothers, and I've been desperately trying to figure out the right contact to try to get like a Venture Brothers comic book going, and I am failing at every turn. The closest I got was speaking to someone at Adult Swim before they stopped contact. So there goes that white whale. But that was my little Easter egg that I put in there.
Well, you've made the both of us happy, so
Yes.
I made myself happy with that. It's just nice to do that.
Now, many more of your Easter eggs are references to your previous work. Specifically, I'm thinking of Villain Seeking Hero. When people kind of see that in there and get a little curious, do you have stuff from your back catalog ready to go in case people want to check it out?
Not at all. Getting a Villain Seeking Hero is probably the equivalent of looking for the Holy Grail at this point. I felt that with this needed a lot of legally distinct characters. And I was like, oh man, if only I had an entire like superhero universe already like in the bucket. Like, and I'm like, oh wait, I do. And there's currently nothing going on with them. So I'm like, well, that's perfect. I already have a lot of the designs and materials, so I could reuse a lot of the characters. There are some Villain Seeking Hero fans, all 10 of them, who have seen some of the promotional materials and been like, wait a minute, like what's going on here? And I've been telling people this is very much like a spiritual sequel, because that book never got its time in the sun. COVID, Action Lab disappearing into the night, like that's a whole thing. So this is like the actual first ever appearance of a lot of these characters, and they're basically just window dressing, if I'm being honest. But I am happy to actually use them in quite possibly like the biggest thing I've got going on in my career as of right now. So it's really nice to let them see the sun.
Villain Seeking Hero got published digitally in 2020 during the height of the pandemic, during the height of comics not knowing how the F to react to it. What was that time like for you as a young buck just starting out in the industry?
Well, so I had probably signed on a few September or October of 2019, and they approved the book. We made 18 issues together, and it's like, okay, we got this big plan, gonna go for it. And I thought I was hot shit. I was like, oh yeah, this book's gonna come out. It's gonna be a big hit, and everyone's gonna read it, and I'm gonna be an all-star. And then everything happened, and that was, I've told a lot of young and up-and-coming creators, the greatest lesson you can receive in comics is getting a nice handful of failures under your belt, because it will slowly teach you what to do and what not to do. And Villain Seeking Hero was a great what not to do thing, where it's like independent superhero book, long running, working with a publisher that at the time I didn't know this, but not doing so hot. So like, that was, if anything, the worst step forward. And I really at the time, you'd be seeing me hanging around the local bridge, but like in retrospect, I really look at it as that was a great big reality check of getting into this industry and understanding what can happen, what you should do, and what you should look out for. And I really try to advise a lot of younger creators to avoid what has happened to me, because I don't want that to happen to them. Obviously, I can't predict the future. I don't know what publishers are planning, so I very much tell everyone to tread cautiously, while still trying their best to get out there. Because even though things may not go well, at the end of the day, you can still say you work with a publisher, you have all this experience under your belt, and like that is time well spent, and that is time people will recognize to see that you were working and you were working hard.
Ultimately, is there like a top lesson or whatever that the past few years have taught you about working with publishers?
Working with publishers, I can't say I've learned. Every publisher works a bit differently. There are some people that end up becoming nightmares to work with. There are others that you can't say a bad word about. And how you act with them is entirely dependent on your situation and how that company acts with you. Overall, in terms of the comics industry, I've sort of repeated this piece of advice that I tell to a lot of people of any age and of any experience, because I find that a lot of people underestimate the power of this thing, and it is just send an email. Wait, that's my little trademark thing, because every like not like every kind of big thing that's ever happened in my career thus far, or valuable connection, or kind of like thing that has happened, especially as I've gotten older, has been rooted in me being, I don't want to use the word ballsy, but maybe me being dumb enough to be like, hey, can you s spend a minute and talk to me? You don't know who I am, but I'll make it worth your while. Let's have a chat. And it doesn't work 100% of the time, but the times it has worked, I am really thankful for how things have turned out. So that is my thing. If you're just if there's someone you want to talk to or a company you want to talk to, obviously you can't be like, hey, publish me. I am a great person. Like, you have to be smart and tactful with what you're trying to do. Maybe find an editor that works there and you can ask them for permission, being like, hey, I'm a writer. I would like to, it would it be okay if I showed you some things I'm working on or would like to make? And some will actually get right back to you and say, yeah, of course, shoot them my way. With how long they may take to get back to you, it may take a while, but it's definitely an option if you don't really want to forever be a slave to the submissions portal of all the comic publishers' websites. So yeah, no, and also pull quotes. You know, if there's a big creator or like a big person that you feel would help boost your book, always try to give it a go, because you will not expect who will get back to you. For instance, when I was doing Midnight Western Theater Witch Trial, I reached out to Patton Oswalt, well, his agent, and then I'm like, well, shot in the dark, it's never going to go anywhere, move on. And then like 3 weeks later, they got back to me, and it's like, oh yeah, you read it, you liked it, here you go. And it was literally like that. It wasn't even like a big email, which was like, here you go. And it's like, well, there we go then. Like, you know, it worked. So it really doesn't matter who you are or what you're doing. You just gotta take that risk.
So this is in many ways an ambitious project, you know, in the number of people you're working with and the comprehensiveness of the history it's covering, et cetera. Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
I'm in a fabulous mansion. I'm worth $1 billion. I'm surrounded by the hottest babes imaginable, and I've already written. I'm currently writing my third Batman Spider-Man crossover, which is projected to sell more than Jim Lee's X-Men number one. So that's where I'm at in 5 years.
We've done it. We
Realistic.
found C.B. Cebulski's million-selling comic. Yay!
We did it. Realistically, like, I just hope that I'm still doing what I'm doing, and that I'm working with more publishers. I'm making the stories I want to tell, and I'm working with the people I love working with, and making good art, good stories, and just doing my best while not getting. Funnily enough, I made a promise to myself that if I don't get to a certain point by age 30, I'm calling it quits. I'm moving to Alaska and I'm just going to become a fisherman. So if I don't hit my personal goal, then Lewis Southard will go off into the night and head on to the nearest boat. So that's my backup plan. That's plan B.
If you get to that point, get in touch. My wife's cousin runs a general store up in Talkeetna, so you've got a contact.
If not that, I want to be the bartender that's always like polishing a glass whenever people walk into the bar. Never pour a drink, just always polishing glass, being like, "What's your trouble?" That's the other, that's plan C if fisherman doesn't work out so well.
Okay. Comics, fish, or glass cleaning. Love
That
it.
sounds like the accurate trajectory.
So we're in a again, scare quotes, comics are dying period right now. Sales are down, publishers are more risk averse, though there have been some new ones cropping up recently. The adaptation game has slowed down because of the Hollywood strike and streamers deleting content and rushing to cancel things, and everyone is afraid of AI. And just generally, we're in this sort of odd post-pandemic, post-inflation hangover phase. What do you think the next era of comics living looks like?
Comics living, how do you mean by that?
In other words, like
Like
the
rates?
we're in the valley. Where does the
Oh,
peak?
yeah. Okay,
Yeah.
I got you. Well, I find that we are already seeing signs. Well, when people say comics are dying, especially with the most recent time, they're always referring to just Marvel and DC. If you look at a lot of independent publishers, they're doing just A-okay, if not even better than before. You look at everything Image is doing with Skybound, I would say they have some of their biggest hits in a while. Of course, that's licensed IP, and maybe juggernauts that were more independent, that were once bigger, let's say Saga, they're not doing so hot, but you see a lot of books that are really taking things by storm just by being very different. I will quote like Patrick Horvath's Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees. Like that's been sparking a lot of interest, and I've read it. I love it. It's wonderfully drawn and it's a fantastic story. And I think that's kind of the mark of what anyone wants. Anyone just wants good art and a good story. And I feel like we need to be in more of a quality over quantity phase. And you see different published, you see Marvel and DC slowly doing that. I think what Marvel is doing with their Ultimates line is really sparking that interest again. There are plenty of people who I've heard so many stories and I've experienced in my own comic shops of very people who've never been there before coming in to try to get new number ones, and not just Spider-Man, but of Black Panther and X-Men. All because there is like a strong vision there. And I think that's the thing people want. They just want to see that there is, they don't want a book where the lights are on, but nobody's home. They want to see that this is something that's clearly the writer and the creative team. They want to make it because they feel a strong urge to do so, and they want to make it the best thing possible. And I know there are rumblings at DC that they're slowly building up to. I think Scott Snyder is working in tandem with them on something in the horizon. And I think like that is, it's just new jumping on points based around like strong visions, which is obviously what you need to get new readers in. And what they're doing, it's not even like scary for longtime readers. If anything, a lot of these things are concepts that not only do you want to see or have been wanting to see, like I know I'm sick of Peter Parker being like a 30-something loser, and I'm so happy to see a book where he's like a competent adult and deals with adult problems while still being fun. Like that's so interesting to me, and it feels like the natural progression point. And then like you have Peach Momoko's X-Men, that's so incredibly different than anything going on. And while it feels manga inspired, it still is rooted in Marvel and has that kind of fun. And because it's a blending of the two, I feel like you're going to unlock a completely different audience for that. And it's just new stuff. So I'm, if anything, we need a lull. We need a downward point to rise up again and to really look at ourselves and be like, well, why are we here and what can we do to fix this? Which is very much like how I felt with this thing. Like, I hated people being rude against, a diverse array of people, whether they be old heads, young creators, trans or queer or whatever, and like saying like maybe their stories don't matter. And I think that's bullshit, to use a swear. Like, I think these people are making some of the greatest art right now, and they are working hard. And in this AI art climate and everything, I wanted to support people, which is what this book was partly about. I wanted to find 100 people who love comics who can help with a comic that is all about comics. And I feel like we really succeeded there.
So to just briefly circle to the thing that connected us back last year, you were one of the creators caught up in the, I'll use the word Michigas because you've already used our swear at Scout Comics when it came to your book Midnight Western Theater. And we can also cut this if for legal reasons you can't talk for your own frustration, you don't want to, you want to rail. Have you been able to recoup any of that IP?
I could talk about this. I am happy to say that Scout and I reached a mutual agreement, and I am now the proud owner of the publishing and multimedia rights for Midnight Western Theater, the entire series. So I was able to leave that company, and I don't know if you guys have are that caught up in my lore, but I've been wanting to leave the company for a while now. And with this situation, it seemed as though we realized that no one wanted to be working together anymore. And that ended in possibly the best thing for all parties involved. As a little tease, I am happy to say that I am currently in talks with a different publisher about their first priority is giving me what I always wanted in my life, which is a Midnight Western Theater trade paperback, which will collect all 10 issues of the first book and the second book in one complete edition. And perhaps, who's to say, if all things go well, maybe we will see where we go from there, and we will see some more rootin' tootin' cowboy shooting in the future.
That answered the next question because I love Hortensia and I want to know what happens next.
Well, I appreciate that. I love Hortensia too, and I felt with everything, with the way things were going, that the sequel prequel did not get as much love as the first one, not by fans, but definitely by let's say marketing pushing. So it kind of came and went, and which I hated because I feel the sequel is probably 10 times better than the first one. But that's just my opinion. But I, yeah, no, but I'm very looking forward to seeing what we'll do next with it. So it looks like everything's going to be peachy keen, and I'm very excited to get back to that universe when I can. If you guys want to know future stuff in terms of what's in the works, I am current I'm working with my first ever licensed IP. So I finally they finally let me into the ranks of working with somebody else's toys. And right now we are finalizing everything with the license holders. And if all goes according to plan, you will either see that late quarter this year or early next year. And I'm very pleased with how that turned out. I'm not going to say with who. All I'm going to say is that the publisher I'm working with, quite possibly the loveliest publisher I've ever worked with in my entire career. Everyone there has been amazing to work with and a real joy.
Well, that is excellent to hear. Any upcoming signings, appearances, conventions, anything like that?
I will be next month in May. I will be at MCM London. I will have my little. I'll be selling my jams and my morsels to the people. And then after that, I have Thought Bubble in November. So mostly UK cons this year.
What is a book by another creator that you are excited for right now?
Currently coming out or is coming out?
Either way.
Cool. I am really big on David Pepos right now. Everything that he's doing with Space Ghost, it seems I love Space Ghost, the original and the Coast to Coast. So I am real keen on seeing. He was kind enough to let me read the first issue, and I am so excited to see more of that. In terms of maybe some smaller stuff, Dave Cook, a wonderful Scottish creator, is doing a Kickstarter right now for Kiltopia Nano Jams, which is a an anthology centered around his cyberpunk universe. So I'm very keen on supporting that and getting my hands on that. Anything bigger? I'm just gonna keep reading Ultimate Spider-Man. I love that. That's my thing. I want to see what J. Jonah Jameson and Ben Parker do with their new company. I am that when they revealed that Harry Osborn's married to Gwen Stacy, I'm like, okay, you're feeding me good stuff, Hickman. Keep going. And I'm real that if anything, that's made me feel like a kid again in terms of comics. It feels good to be excited for Spider-Man, and like that's been such a joy. And my comic shop, the lady who runs it, she's like, damn you, you keep buying the Ultimate Spider-Man, and I keep seeing the resale prices. Like you always come in and get the last copy, and I'm always like, oh, I can't wait to resell this. And I'm like, sorry, Wendy, it's going home with me. So yeah, no, it's good fun.
I'm loving Ultimate Spider-Man, and the thing I am loving most is Uncle Ben and Jonah as just these two old cranks that are like, fuck this, we're gonna start our own newspaper.
That was badass in the issue one where they just both leave together. It's like, screw it, we're gonna go do our own thing. Yeah, no, it like this is what I was saying earlier. It's just like we need these books that make people feel excited and make people feel like, oh man, I need to keep going. And like obviously these are long running books, or they're planned to be long running, and that's the trick. I want to feel like I'm gonna go on a journey, and it seems like they're making good steps towards that.
What else are you reading now? This doesn't have to be new stuff coming out. This could be prose. This could be stuff you're revisiting. What's some stuff you're into right now?
Well, upon completing this whole project, I treated myself against my partner's wishes to a somewhat expensive book that I'd been eyeing up for a while, but I said I did a good job. I'm gonna give this to myself and then regret it at a later date. And I'm a big Shazam Captain Marvel fan, and I mentioned it earlier. The Monster Society of Evil, the first Mr. Mind story, like they will not reprint that, and justifiably so. Because there are a lot of insensitive portrayals of other races in that book. So obviously, best to stay away from that. But as a comics history person and like as a Captain Marvel fan, I really wanted to check it out to see what it even was. It's the first ever like serial and story arc. Curiosity got me. And the last time they reprinted it was in the UK in the 1980s. And I got myself that collection, which goes for a pretty penny. And I read that and I very much enjoyed it. Quite possibly my most favorite chapter in it is Captain Marvel has to, Captain Marvel is recruited by Hollywood to make an anti-Mr. Mind movie, and they want him to be a consultant. They're like, we need to tell people about this horrible worm. Like, come in and basically tell us all the terrible things about him. And he does that, and then Mr. Mind shows up, and he's like, they're getting me all wrong. And so, like, he uses his Monster Society to basically take over the Hollywood studio and just like, we're gonna make the movie ourselves, and I'm gonna show everyone how great I am. And like, there's this great little panel of he's sitting in a tiny director's chair with like the little cardboard, like, oh, I don't know, funnel to shout into, and he's got the beret, and it's like, okay, we're gonna do it. And that's like the kind of silly, not so stuff that you could only find in older books that just got a kick out of me. In terms of like more modern stuff that's on my pile, my laptop is currently set on top of it. I am rereading all of Alan Moore's Tom Strong, because that is one of my feel good books. Like, that's just good fun, and I always like a more happy Alan Moore. I know most people want on a lovely Sunday afternoon when the sun is shining and the flowers are out and fresh air, light breeze, you just want to crack open From Hell and just have a nice time. But for me, it's Tom Strong. That's my way to have a nice Sunday afternoon.
Lewis, this has been a fantastic time. Final question as we release you back into the world. How can people follow you online and keep up with Comics Are Dying, the comic, and everything else you got going on?
Well, you can find me at Lewis Southard or at Lewis J. Southard on Instagram and Twitter and Blue Sky and Threads and all the other beautiful social media platforms. I'm also www.lewissouthard if you want to learn all my lore. You can find the Comics Are Dying campaign on Zoop. Right now, we've reached over our goal, and we are on the road to 10K. We want to get our first stretch goal. We want to make this like the best book possible for everyone supporting it. So if this has piqued your curiosity, please support it, and let's try to make this the best thing. So yeah, find us at Zoop at Comics Are Dying the comic.
All right, Lewis, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. As a reminder, you can find the Comics XF interview podcast at Comics XF, along with our sister podcasts, Battle of the Atom and Bat Chat with Matt and Will, a Batman ranking podcast co-hosted by Matt Lazowitz and Will Nevin. You can listen to the Comics XF interview podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Amazon Music, Audible, and at comicsxf.com, where new episodes move Tuesday mornings. You can support Comics XF at patreon.com/comicsxf, where a dollar donation gets you a shout out at the end of every episode of the Comics XF interview podcast. A $2 donation gets you early access to this podcast and a shout out at the end of every episode. A $3 donation gets you a sticker, early access, and a shout out. A $5 donation gets you access to our monthly bonus podcast, Our Son Pete, a deep dive into the comic appearances of British mutant spy master Pete Wisdom. A $25 donation lets you request a primer, one of our custom reading guides for a series, character, or creator. And a $50 donation lets you advertise on the show. Big thanks to our patrons, Joel Elod, Shelf Dust, Lisa Slack, Will Redman, Tobias Carroll, Mike Sagawa, Will Nevin, Liz Large, Asimov Fangirl, Carla Pacheco, and Robert Secundus. You're all special, and we love you. You can follow Comics XF on Twitter at Comics XF, me at Daniel P. Grote, and Matt Lazowitz at MattLaz1013. You can also follow Comics XF on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. And until next week, remember, Marvel Editor-in-Chief C.B. Cebulski once wrote comics under the pen name Akira Yoshida.